I think it leads to people misemphasizing things. So there was a quote that Rick Doblin, the head of MAPS, gave in 2006, where he said, "I started thinking about how traumatic it would be for a police officer to see the murdered body of a pregnant woman. I experienced some compassion for the police." And then as a result of that, MAPS and this other organization developed a memorandum of understanding for a potential study of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD in Canadian RCMP officers. And when I read that quote, I was just struck by the fact that, like, so you heard about a murdered pregnant woman and immediately you thought about how traumatic it would be for the cop finding her body? Like what about her family? What about, like that's just such a weird, like, it strikes me as such a misplaced engagement. Yeah. And it seems, you know, I this is purely speculative, but, like, this has that sort of support the troops logic, right? That if you can support, you know, back the blue, support the troops, like, there's that propaganda inherent to that, which I would agree with you. I think that's inherently resistant to the notion of engaging in systemic critique. Because at the point where you're asking, well, why do we have police, or why do we have soldiers, or why are we engaged in endless foreign wars, you're already so far off script as far as, you know, what we're expected to engage in as far as societal norms that can't really have that.
Hey everybody, thank you very much for tuning in. In this episode, I speak with David Nichols. David is the managing editor of Symposia. He is an underground researcher and harm reduction advocate. He has presented social critiques and commentary on psychedelic culture and radical politics, as well as novel phytochemical data from the DMT Nexus at venues around the world. His work focuses on the social and cultural implications of psychoactive substances, utilizing critical theory and structural analysis to examine the intersections of drugs and society. He is a vocal opponent of the mainstreaming and commodification of psychedelic compounds and rituals, believing that such approaches inherently obscure the liberatory potential of psychedelic experiences. Along with being the managing editor of Symposia, he's also a writer, a journalist. He does really excellent exposés digging into the ways in which psychedelics are being mainstreamed. Corporations and other capitalist interests are basically hijacking, you could say, this whole idea of what it means to legalize or effectively decriminalize drug use in the United States and in other parts of the world as well. We really have to push back against this and this thing that David talks about, because it overly simplifies scientific data and how scientific information is being presented to the public. Because ultimately the goal of capitalism, or the goal of capitalists, is to, you know, take something like psychedelics and make it into a commodity, something that can be bought and sold, something that can be presented to you as a solution to all of your problems. Now, certainly psychedelics are an incredible tool for healing trauma, for, you know, dealing with your internal ailments, the things that make us miserable right now. Certainly, and this thing that David and I talk about, we've had very profound personal experiences with psychedelics, and we have cultivated a deep love and appreciation and respect for psychedelics. And that is why David, in particular, has been pushing back against the mainstreaming of psychedelic substance use, particularly through this corporate branding lens that we're now seeing coming into full force. And he talks about why this is a dangerous trend and what this is potentially leading towards. We talk about it in these kind of within a dystopian framework, this sort of unholy alliance of psychedelic use and surveillance capitalism. And yeah, it's a really excellent discussion. I really, really enjoyed talking with David. He has some really profound insights into this subject. And another thing that we also talk about is, and this is something that I talked about also with a colleague of David's, another individual from Symposia, Brian Pace. Brian Pace had written a really excellent article for Symposia last year called Lucy in the Sky with Nazis. And he talks about the intersections of psychedelia, the popularization of psychedelics, and the far right. So we talk about the intersections of all these different things, how psychedelics has been branded as being this the solution to all of our problems. Like, if everyone could just have psychedelic therapy done, you know, you go take ayahuasca or have an MDMA session with a therapist or what have you, that'll somehow fix all of our problems that we have collectively and individually in this society that we are a part of. What David presents is a little more radical and more subversive in the sense of, like, look, David and I, for example, we both love psychedelics. We've had very positive experiences with them, but we understand that psychedelics are not going to fix our problems. They can't. They're tools. They work with what you got. And just as much as I had a very profound positive experience with psychedelics early on in my 20s especially, which have been very important to my development as an adult, I have come to recognize over the years, especially doing this podcast, that psychedelics are a tool. That's it. It works with what's in your head already. It works with what you're around, your environment, your set and setting. So just as much as I had ideas kicking around in my head that pushed me towards a more leftist position on these things, psychedelics could just as easily be used and produce an effect on a person's consciousness to lead them in another direction entirely. And there's this sort of ignorance or this deep naivety that we see with a lot of the proponents of psychedelic use. They may have good intentions. They may be trying to promote something that's ultimately positive, but we must understand the context in which these things are emerging. You know, what does it mean to have psychedelics legalized in a late capitalist system? I mean, does that fix capitalism and the exploitation that occurs under a capitalist paradigm? No. In fact, we could argue that psychedelics will be used, just like other pharmaceutical drugs, to kind of manage the symptoms that come up, the alienation, the mental disorders, the emotional distress that comes from existing within a capitalist paradigm that is exploitive. Psychedelics, again, can do incredible things and have done incredible things, but we have to have really a clear understanding of what's happening with the mainstreaming of psychedelic use. Because we are, unfortunately, and there's many reasons why we're heading towards, and we already actually exist within a dystopia already, but we're heading towards a kind of late capitalist, sort of surveillance capitalism, chemical dystopia. That was a clunky way of basically describing what David presents in a far more articulate manner in this discussion. So I really deeply appreciate what David is doing. I deeply appreciate what Symposia is doing. As I stated in this interview, I really think this is an incredible resource. We need these people that are working at Symposia because, unfortunately, there's so much misinformation and just the corporatization of psychedelics now that, you know, to even have a clear scientific understanding of what psychedelics actually do can be a bit challenging, unfortunately, because scientific misinformation or pseudo-scientific information can be presented as presented to the public and get published as if it's like a peer-reviewed fact. And so as people who are very excited, like I'm very excited for the fact that people are starting to understand that psychedelics are a valuable tool for therapy, for self-exploration, I am totally on board with that idea up to the point where we recognize that we cannot really expect the legalization and the decriminalization of psychedelic substances as being like a solution for everything that we're experiencing right now. It's that way of thinking that's a real problem right now. And I think Symposia brings a lot of clarity to that subject, and they're pushing back against a lot of this misinformation and again, the corporatization and mainstreaming of psychedelic use. So yeah, I really would recommend if people want to learn more about Symposia to go to the website symposia.com. That is PSYMPOSIA.com. You can find David's work on that website. I'll be putting links to some of his more recent articles that we reference in this interview. Also, I would ask that you please go subscribe to the Plus Three podcast, which is at symposia.com/podcast/plus3. I think you can subscribe to it and listen to it anywhere you listen to podcasts. So please go check that out as well. Also, you can support Symposia at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/symposia. Again, I'll be putting the links to all these resources in the description of this episode. And if you would like to learn more about my work specifically, you can do that by going to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you would like to support my work, you can do that through a couple different means. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal or Venmo. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, donate through that, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. If you would like to sustain this work on a monthly or yearly basis, please consider doing that through my Patreon account at patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And by doing that, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. All right, everybody, that's all I got. I really just deeply appreciated this discussion with David. Oh, one last thing. I had a little technical issue with my audio during the recording. So the quality of my audio is going to be slightly less than what I normally have for these podcasts. David's audio is actually really good. His is really pristine and really good, but mine's a little... some parts of it are a little like potato quality, unfortunately. That was just a technical issue that came up on my end that I found out about a little too late. So anyway, that happens occasionally. I just would recommend, if anybody is recording podcasts, redundancy is your friend. If you can record on multiple things at once, do that. That way you have options in case something goes wrong. That's just my two cents. Anyway, that is all I got, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with David Nichols. I don't know if we're officially starting yet, but this is always how it goes, is it just starts rolling into the conversation. But, you know, of course, I've been absorbing your articles and listening to the Plus 3 podcast and watching the YouTube channel. Symposia's YouTube channel. And I was telling my partner actually this. I was like, you know, when I started doing this podcast, that was a big branch that I was covering a lot was psychedelia, because I had so many profound experiences with it. And I was like approaching it from almost a rosy lens, you know, like this is a tool that can save the world, you know, and I had this like naivety or optimism built into that. And then I was telling her, I was like, I remembered the thing that really switched me over to becoming more critical of it was Kevin Tucker's book, The Coal of Personality. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And I interviewed him about it. And that's when I realized like, oh, like there's like neocolonialism, the extractive industry, you've got like all of this stuff that's intersecting here. And it's not as simple as just saying everyone should just take ayahuasca or LSD and all of our problems will be mended and fixed. And it was such an obvious thing once it clicked, because I'm like, I'm already an anarchist. I already implement an anti-capitalist perspective into my work. Why wouldn't I be critical of the direction psychedelics are going in, not in how they actually are as chemical compounds and how they operate within the human body or in the consciousness of those that take it, but that it exists within a social social context, an economic context, a material context. And you can't just assume that if you hand this over to corporations and capitalists that they're just going to approach it with a sort of an enlightened or altruistic or egalitarian lens, you know, like, of course not. And so I just wanted to say, like, my approach, I was just laughing about it with her, because I'm like, now I'm just a super, I don't want to be cynical, but like, I love psychedelics and I don't want to see them get hijacked in this way. So I've been a lot more critical over the past year or so when I talk about psychedelics. Yeah.
And I'd say I relate to that big time. You know, I listened to your interview with Brian Pace from Symposia as well, and he sends his regards. But hearing you frame some of it, both in that discussion and the rundown that you just gave, like, for me, I resonate with that quite strongly. Like, I would say that when I found psychedelics, and for me, like that sort of enthusiasm and optimism and naivete, like for me, that goes back to that, my first mushroom experience where it was incredibly political. I mean, it was also very personally meaningful and had themes of sort of addressing longstanding fears of death that went back to like earliest childhood memories and my grandmother dying and trying to process all of that. And like, you know, having had an experience of sort of timeless unity followed by what I consider to be my first radical synthesis. I mean, prior to identifying, let's say, as an anarchist or anti-authoritarian or what have you, to suddenly have all of these understandings of industrial civilization and capitalism and sort of my role in it at university to get a degree to then like function within these societies as I'm having these revelations about ecological integrity and sort of the world of work and the way that, you know, workers versus bosses versus, you know, ecocide unfurling on the planet, you know, as that's all sort of cascading through the trip, coming down from that and looking back at it, it's like the two sort of revelations of there's a world that's here, like just beyond my fingertips, and it's always here and it's always accessible. But then also that revelation of like, whoa, like, I can take those realizations and see where they line up with the real world. Like if I've come away with a sense of, you know, intersections of capitalism and ecocide, and then I start doing research on, well, how does this actually, like do these intersections hold up? And realizing that, oh, there's entire like tracts on deep ecology or on green anarchism that like make these points in well-articulated and well-researched manners. To take that understanding and to look around and say, well, we have psychedelics. Why aren't the people who are having these experiences coming away with similar understandings? Because I remember on that first, you know, maybe a couple months after that first trip, being home from university on break and encountering a friend's sister who was like 16 at the time, who'd also just done mushrooms. And I was like, oh, so, you know, you get the implications of like, you know, human social relations and, you know, all of this stuff. And she just looked at me like I was, like I'd grown a second head and started talking about the pretty lights that she'd seen in the forest.
Right. Yeah, no, I had a similar thing because when I first took mushrooms, it was one of the most profound like experiences. And I had this sense of just connection to all things. And it was just, it was really intense. And then coming down from that, and then I had other people that I was in circles with that took the same amount of mushrooms I did, and they didn't change at all. They didn't have any profound insights. They just talked about the visuals they had, and it was just like really superficial, and I was very confused. And I don't know, I was put off by that, but I didn't really make sense of it. Didn't really make sense of that until a little later on. You know, and I think it's actually a bit dangerous to assume other people are going to have those types of experiences that you personally have with them. And I, more than anything, I realize it is just that. It's a tool. It can allow you to, it's a really important tool. And I think it's a really important part of the human experience. And I think many people would benefit from it greatly. But to think that you know, just that hippie logic of like, if everybody just took LSD, then we would all be happy hippie people living in the forest together. And I was like, I realized how really fucking naive and that actually sounds now. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it blows me away that people do make the assertion and that like it didn't go away. You know, if you look back at Abby Hoffman and the Yippies and the 68 convention talking about dose the water. Right. And at the time it was understood as a prank, like, you know, OK, a couple politicians took it seriously and deployed. I think it was National Guard troops around the municipal water supplies. But like the fact is like dose the water has existed since then, at least as a meme of like, oh, like mass societal change on the back of widespread psychedelic experiences. And there's currently, you know, I think the thing that really floors me about where the discourse is currently at is that the proponents of medicalization are really pushing a dose the water 2.0, where it's if we can get psychedelics into every therapist's office, that will somehow change society through this sort of neoliberal, personalized, individualized self-work, self-growth, self-healing, that then somehow that will propagate up, trickle out, you know, whatever, and somehow transform society. And when you ask the people who are pushing these models for any sort of social or political analysis or history or rundown of sort of material conditions that would produce the changes that they're contending will come from this, they don't really have a lot to say about it. I mean, and it's worth noting that most of them aren't actually like involved in the social sciences. A lot of these are clinicians. But the thing that strikes me about it is that they feel very comfortable making those assertions. I think partly because psychedelia has been a bit of an echo chamber and has been sort of a, hey, we've faced widespread repression. We need to put our best face forward and sort of present, play respectability politics with dominant culture, sort of show that we're not here to upset the apple cart. We're just here to change society completely through not upsetting the apple cart. You know, it just doesn't hold.
Yeah. And this is something that just I thought of because I did speak with Brian Pace a year or so ago. And of course, that was the first time I had really become exposed to Symposia. I realized I've been following, of course, Symposia now ever since then. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate everything that you all put together and put out there. It's really needed. And I'm like, man, this is like the thing that I wish I had from the beginning of my psychedelic experiences. It would have really helped. And it is helped. I mean, I think it's helping a lot of people.
Thanks.
Yeah. And like, how did you all find each other? Like, how do, like, what happened? Like, I'm curious, like, how did this project even like come into, I mean, obviously it makes sense why it would come up. I get that. But like, how did you all find each other and like start this thing?
So yeah, it's been a long, strange trip, fittingly enough. But so just for me, like after my early psychedelic experiences, I mean, I was a freshman at university. I thought that I sort of had this realization that look, like ideally I can find a way to study this, you know, within the academy, that wouldn't that be a great way to sort of eke out a living and avoid sort of bullshit work, whatever.
Sure.
And so, you know, I ended up pursuing anthropology and political science, hoping that like that would lead to some sort of PhD track and being able to do ethnobotany, perhaps in a bona fide context. And in the course of, I was just voraciously reading Erowid and Wikipedia and sort of any sort of material, peer-reviewed studies, anything dealing with psychedelics and their history and countercultural, content. Also, I mean, that opened me up to, let's say, more radical politics in general. I mean, seeing the intersection of the Weather Underground with, Tim Leary, with the Black Panthers, with, you know, like, as you start, like, seeing those things come up, it raised a lot of questions. You know, at the same time, I was on Erowid looking at like extraction techs for DMT, eventually like ended up, getting to try DMT. And then as a result of like ongoing, deep breakthrough experiences with that, like one day I was typing into Google, not expecting any sort of answers, but it was like, how is it possible to encounter disincarnate entities on DMT? You know, again, not expecting like a real response, but like 3 months into like daily and near daily trips, it was just like, what the hell is going on here? I found the DMT Nexus, which at the time it was like I was able to contribute to some of the extraction troubleshooting and the botanical research. I ended up working for a botanist for a period of time and was able to help with like plant distributions and help coordinate some analysis. Like we did phytochemical analysis with a little lab out in Spain called Energy Control. They're great people. They actually do substance testing. You can mail them stuff even internationally. They'll do like full GCMS, in some cases HPLC analysis, tell you pretty much everything that's in your sample. And they'll do it anonymized as well, so you can ensure your safety, you know, just in case there's listeners who are interested in testing their drugs and being sure of what they've got. But they helped us put together this whole rundown of phytochemistry in ayahuasca plants, in other, you know, entheogenic psychedelic preparations. And I got invited to share some of that material initially by Nishay Devineau, who's also on the symposia team. We had a chance encounter at a rainbow gathering, which I went to and was hanging out at this like primitive skills camp called Green Path. And I couldn't really deal with most of the hippies there, but like the Green Path folks were like sort of, you know, again, like some material analysis, some like real world skills. There was a shamanic plants talk, and I got looped up with Nishay as a result of that. She invited me to the UPenn conference she was hosting. Lily K. Ross, who's also at Symposia, gave a talk there dealing with sort of the claims of authority and power that people were making. And this was back in 2012. That led to like MAPS accepting the phytochemical analysis talk. And those talks were both, you know, I couldn't keep my politics out of it. Actually, at the UPenn conference, I ended up troubleshooting a bunch of DMT and mescaline extractions while giving like presentation. But we, as a result of that, like I got invited to give talks at festival type deals. And I was so disgusted with the sort of level of discourse, whether it was, you know, dose the water type assertions, or it was sort of, The Secret, right? Yeah. The sort of, you can manifest the world that you want to see.
Oh my God, dude.
Yeah. Well, so I didn't have anything tied to psychedelia. Like I wasn't looking to make a career of it. Like my take on it was like, look, I'm a weirdo who works dead end jobs so I can spend too much time on a drugs forum contributing to like work that I find interesting. And as a result of that, like I'd show up and basically lob a couple epistemological bombs, be like, hey, like, you know, the emperor wears no clothes. I don't think y'all are really thinking about this. Just straight up like call out the bullshit that I saw, whether it was from like abusive practitioners or speakers who I thought were just peddling bullshit. And so that sort of spotlight was up, and Nishay and I had a bunch of interactions over the years around various projects, around sort of abusive practitioners. And I, as a result of some of that, like phytochemical analysis and other more hard sort of drug nerd science, whatever, got linked up with a bunch of sanctioned researchers, you know, folks who were working at some of the large academic institutions. They were super supportive. I was advocating for sort of discrete communication between above ground researchers, underground researchers. You wind up with a lot of, if you look at like sort of initial studies, you'll see people will say something like, anecdotal evidence suggests that, and then they'll sort of lay it out. And so it was like, cool, like if we can have more of these kinds of discussions to give researchers a starting data point of like, hey, maybe look into some of this, I think there could be interesting science done. Now, at that point, I wasn't thinking about like corporate encroachment. I wasn't thinking about where is this all going? Nobody had been doing sort of pharmaceutically oriented studies. Everything that was being done in the university context was sort of for pure interest or pure science. Maybe that's a naive way to present it, but the way the studies, I mean, it's part of the reason that the researchers were able to get away using sort of a slightly lower tier of compound, right? It's not that the compounds were less pure, but they didn't have to be up to a certain pharmaceutical standard because they weren't looking to turn these into pharmaceutical products. So fast forward a few years to 2018, and all of a sudden, like, I got wind of this company, Compass Pathways, that was coming onto the scene. They'd been around for a couple years at that point. They had been a nonprofit, and then pivoted to a for-profit. And I had friends who were researchers who had been kind of fucked over by them. I had friends in the community who were aware of some of the moves that they'd been making behind the scenes. And when I started, raising some concerns and questions about what was going on, it got to a point where I made a Facebook post where I tagged pretty much every mainstream psychedelic researcher, a bunch of like the millionaire, you know, donors, philanthropists, whatever, and was like, here are a bunch of the issues I see. Like, I have my perspective on it. I have my opinion on it. I'm not going to put that out here, but like, I'd like to see discussion of that. Mm-hmm. And once that kind of like blew up and there were quite a few discussions that started from that, I got hooked up with Brian Normand from Symposia. I mean, he and I had met back in 2015 at they had a conference called Envisioning a Post-Prohibitionist World, which I would credit with sort of focusing some of the critiques I'd been offering at that point, where it was like, okay, let's imagine that drugs are now decriminalized or illegal and everything else about industrial capitalism is the same. What does that look like? You know, what do we see? And I predicted like a rise in detention, you know, for-profit prisons or immigration detention centers based on what we'd been seeing. I mean, you know, fast forward to 2019, I think it was 2019, maybe 2018, where Trump, you know, signed an expansion of immigration detention centers the same day Canada was legalizing cannabis. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, again, correlation, not causation, but sure. Seeing the way some of that was trending, and seeing that again, people within psychedelia, as I'm sure you're aware, like, weren't really giving it that sort of thought. It was all kind of rose colored, like, oh, we don't have to think about supply chains. We don't really have to think about like what happens to indigenous communities that grow coca as a cash crop. Because, you know, when you look at the amount of money that you can get from that in the current market compared to food staples, it doesn't really hold up. And like, what are all the pressures around that? What happens when cartels switch from like drugs to gun smuggling? How does, you know, like, right. There's so many complex dynamics around supply chains that I think particularly in the context of psychedelic exceptionalism get missed. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the folks involved in symposia, like, we all sort of had these critical perspectives that on their own were kind of getting smothered, or we were being told, you know, oh, it's not, you know, you're being disruptive or you're being too political, or, and one night basically Nishay called me up and was like, in the context of Norman and I being, you know, putting out a bunch of stuff around Compass. And she was like, hey, have you guys considered doing a podcast? And so I was like, well, I don't want to just do something by myself. Like, let's do, you know, let's try to get some broader voices in there. Let's try to have this be a conversation.
Yeah.
And so it all kind of grew out of that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I noticed when I just started doing my work and you just kind of put out a signal, and it's funny because I don't believe in the secret or this like manifesting reality thing, but there is something to be said. Once you set an intention and you start moving in a certain direction, you will start attracting people towards you and ideas towards you that you otherwise wouldn't have come across. And I think that's just the nature of relationship, you know, in general.
I agree.
Yeah, for sure. So I understand that. Like, I'm really glad that you all found each other and that you're all putting out
likewise
super important work. I mean, it's really, it's not, I don't know, like, I read it and I'm like, wow, you're really like exposing these people, like these corporations, these corporate capitalist people. I don't know. It's like, I was reading, I think it was, yeah, you were, I was reading a recent, I think it was an article you published most recently about, I mean, and I think it was also discussed on a recent Plus Three episode where you have made these, like, you follow like what these corporations are trying to present. And they try to present it like it's scientifically verified information that is all like peer reviewed when it isn't. They're just making claims and they can somehow just do it. And it's all a part of this, I imagine, a long game that they're playing, which is like, eventually we can get MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, like all these compounds, these chemical compounds, these psychedelics, we can get them legalized, not decriminalized, legalized, so that we specifically as corporations can benefit from selling these things. Like, it's like really like crucial information that you're presenting. And it's really encouraging to see that. Like, I just have to say that.
I appreciate that. At times it feels just sort of like swimming in the shit, just because it's like, and like the point that you make about them being able to kind of say whatever they want, like Stat News literally ran an article that was claiming that the traditional use of psychedelics was as sub-perceptual anti-inflammatory agents. And it's like, Stat News is not it's a reputable outlet. Like, it's known for like publishing like quality stories about scientific or evidentiary based rundowns of like health and science findings. And like the fact that they just ran this story from a CEO who had every incentive to sort of stretch the truth. And, you know, we reached out to 5 or 6 anthropologists, ethnobotanists, pharmacologists. And they all said, no, like, that's an absurd assertion. Now, that's not to say, like, the thing that kills me about that is that there's really interesting stuff about anti-inflammatory applications of psychedelics. But, like, to make it out in this sensationalized way, like, oh, this is how they've always been used, and indigenous folks said that this is the appropriate way to use them, so now we're doing this weird appeal to authority in this fallacious manner. Like, the whole thing just... it leaves a bad taste. But then, as you point out, like, they're just going for legalization, right? They're going for enclosure of the commons. They're going for a model in which, hey, there has to be, we're talking in the case of FDA approved therapy, we're talking about the FDA approving a drug therapy combo. So it's not just that psilocybin would be legal or just that MDMA would be legal. It's that psilocybin or MDMA, and honestly, like, a particular formulation of psilocybin or MDMA that is proprietary. So in the case of Compass, they've combined psilocybin with a particular, I'm spacing on it. It's a silicified cellulose. There we go. So it's literally, it's filler. It's psilocybin plus filler. They say it makes a particular crystalline form, which they haven't shown is any more or less efficacious than any other form of psilocybin. Once it's dissolved, it's identical to any other form of psilocybin. So then that gets paired with a particular protocol that they get approved through the FDA. So at the end of the day, if everything is demonstrated to be efficacious through these tests, through the clinical trials they're currently doing, they will have a Comp 360 pill plus therapy that then is available for people who can pay potentially thousands and thousands of dollars to take that therapy. Now, it gets way more dystopian because it's not just that they've enclosed the commons around that. It's then that, like, they're combining these things with digital therapeutics, or this is the euphemistic term. Okay. So Compass is like a major investor in Compass is this larger company called Atai Life Sciences. Some of the same people involved in founding Compass also founded Atai. Peter Thiel is involved in Atai. But in this cluster of like Compass partners and Atai holdings, you have, there's a company called Mindstrong Health, which is owned or was created by a guy named Tom Insel, who used to be the head of NIMH. When he was at NIMH, they got rid of the DSM, which is the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual. I'm probably butchering that whole thing.
Mental health, right? Like mental disorders and...
Yes, exactly. And so while he was there, they got rid of it because he was saying Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Mm. So they got rid of it because there are problems with the DSM, absolutely. One of Insel's contentions was that sort of mental health disorders are neurological disorders and that they can be identified within sort of neural circuitry. So, like, you lose the whole social context for, like, you know, you're not depressed because you're living in late capitalism. You're depressed because there's something wrong in your brain.
Right.
And that seems fucked. But so Mindstrong is the smartphone app that knows you're depressed before you do. So you put this app on your phone. It basically gets access to everything that you do on your phone, you know, everything from like your word choice to how long you're looking at different apps, which apps you're interacting with. And it creates this sort of map of you. And this is what a healthy you looks like. And this is what deviations from the norm look like. And obviously, we can think of all sorts of creepy applications beyond like how happy or sad are you, I'm sure. And this is also just one of the surveillance capitalist firms sort of crowding into the space. But now imagine taking the Mindstrong app, pairing it with your, you know, everything from your intake, right? Because they want to use AI for some of the intake around psychedelic therapy. They want to use AI pretty much anywhere where they think they could cut costs around therapists, mm-hmm. Or around, you know, sort of processing this information. So you could imagine therapy data being run through algorithms. You can imagine comparative algorithms between patient A and patient B, as long as they're restricted internally. One of the issues around this stuff is HIPAA is ancient in comparison to most of these sorts of apps and algorithms. And so the sort of big data potential, not only to like, you know, glean insights about all of like things that are literally too tiny, too granular to have meaning to us. So for example, like there's a smartphone app that can predict your credit score based in part on how many times you charge your cell phone in a given day. And, you know, it's when you have these big data sets that you can correlate things across so many different points, suddenly these pictures start emerging and things that otherwise would just be random static start to have significance. So when you think about this in the context of people's potentially deepest, most significant experiences, and then trying to do sense making around that and trying to sort of understand some of what they've gone through, and if you consider this in the realm of like micro targeting and predictive analytics, like being able to track people's emotional states and maybe get insight into when they're most vulnerable or pliable. You know, if we look at MK Ultra, we know that, okay, psychedelics for brainwashing maybe don't really work. But also we see that psychedelics can induce like hyper suggestibility. This also comes out in some of Robin Carhart Harris's work at Imperial College London. We see that, I mean, in the case of MK Ultra, right, like they got torture techniques out of it, even if they didn't get like brainwashing and mind control. Uh-huh. But looking at sort of that dark history with some of what's currently on the table, I think there's a whole lot of dark future ahead of us.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of have this Brave New World kind of quality to it a little bit. And yeah, the trend towards what you're talking about, I mean, that just sounds horrifying. Like, and it, again, it doesn't address the systemic issues. It doesn't address the material conditions. It doesn't address any of these things. Like, why are people anxious? Why are people depressed? Why are all these things happening? This isn't something psychedelics is just going to fix. Like, it can be valuable as a form of therapy and self-exploration and all these things, but it's being branded as something far more than that. And it seems dangerous. It seems a bit like, I don't know. And actually, this is the question. This is just a clarification, because I think it's good for me to know this and for others. But like, people are like, what's the difference between legalizing psychedelics or any of these drugs and decriminalizing them? What's the difference?
Sure. So, I mean,
basic question, but I think it's good to, you know, be clear.
Yeah. Well, and I would say like, it's also kind of complex in the sense that like you can remove criminal penalties without setting up like sanctioned avenues of sale. Like what decrim looks like, right? And depending on, like in a lot of senses, decrim in some places can look like a tax on the poor in the event that they get busted, right? Like if you have, if say you remove like criminal penalties for drug possession, but you keep some sort of civil fine, right? So $100, $200, if you get caught, you're not going to jail, you're not going to get anything on your record, but like you have to pay a fine. Well, you know, if you don't have money to pay a fine, you end up in worse shape than say, like, again, it's sort of legalization for rich folks at that point. Mm-hmm. So if we think about decrim as removing penalties for possession, for growth, I mean, personally, like I'm interested in what might be considered like a grow, gather, give model where, at least for plants, for fungi, for things that are relatively simple for individuals to grow and like that don't come with a whole lot of broader concerns around, let's say, safety, purity, what have you, like the notion of making it so that plants that are currently criminalized are not. Like if we think about grass, right, you can go out and you know, you could smoke a joint of lawn clippings and nobody's, it wouldn't be very smart, but like, right. Nobody's going to give you grief for it. and sure. thinking about like plants, like personally, like I'd like to see plants in that status where it's just like they're plants. They literally, you know, they grow, people can grow them, people can trade them, share them, what have you. Like there's no penalties. And if we look at the history of criminalization, we have Ehrlichman, who was an advisor to Nixon, on the record saying like, look, we knew that that drugs were not dangerous. We just saw this as a way to criminalize black and anti-war protesters and black folks and arrest their community organizers and go after them the whole nine. If we think about legalization, we're talking more like things that would be approved, would be set up for as commodities, right? On the marketplace. Like we're talking about, and if you think about supplements versus say medicines, like depending on how legalization were to be framed, they could look very different, right? Like supplements right now aren't FDA tested. There's no sort of, or at least my understanding is like there's no real regulation or quality control around what's in them.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we were talking about things like, synthetic compounds, MDMA, LSD, you know, semi-synthetic, whatever, like I would be interested. And we've seen in the current criminalized atmosphere that there are people who engage in substance testing. Like, I don't think we necessarily need like tight regulated, control in order to ensure, actual safe, pure compounds. I do think obviously in an unregulated marketplace, you're going to see, high pressures towards bullshit. So, it may be that within the context of capitalism, legalization would require regulation. And again, like these are also frameworks that like I feel like I'm already playing on somebody else's playground. And like the world I want to see is not one where psychedelics exist within late capitalism as like commodified supplements or medicines or even just like recreational compounds. Like I would like to see fundamental like restructuring of society in which like commodity relationships themselves are transformed. And so what we might end up seeing is like a chemist guild that takes it upon themselves to do like analysis and production and things of that nature. I know that that's, you know, speaking to your earlier point about like naive or idealistic views, like totally happy to own that. But I do think when we look at legalization as currently discussed around psychedelics, a lot of it really focuses on medical model. A lot of it focuses on these compounds for therapy or as treatments for particular ailments. And again, going back, there's no scientific or evidentiary basis for criminalization. So to my mind, like that whole premise, the notion that like there needs to be some sort of meeting of a burden of safety around these compounds is just it's nonsensical. Like the prohibitionists technically still bear the burden of proof for prohibiting these compounds.
Yeah.
You know, that's just kind of where things stand. I think also, and sorry to get away a little bit from the decrim versus legal, but when we talk about therapy and the medicalization of this stuff, the reality is there's been a long history of abuse in therapeutic contexts. I mean, if we go back to the 80s, so we can go back prior to the 80s, but in the 80s, the research that was being done around MDMA, they decided to use a two-therapist dyad. So basically a therapist team, male, female. The reason that this was initially implemented, according to a paper by Torsten Passy, is because there were two very prominent cases or individuals who engaged in a number of assaults of patients. They were treating in the underground with MDMA. And the two people, it was Ingrassi and Rick Ingrassi and Francesco DeLeo. And there were Boston Globe articles, certainly on, I think on both of them. But there were quite a few people who were harmed. And the dyad, you know, it really, you could say it goes back to the 60s and Betty Eisner doing LSD studies. But when you look at its sort of reappearance and reemergence and the utilization within the context of MDMA therapy, it came out of this sexual abuse. And that's gone on. Like, there have been ongoing cases of therapist practitioner abuse. I mean, there's been numerous stories on shamanic abuse from people who are engaged in drug tourism. I think Kevin Tucker has offered some pretty great comments about how fucked up the dynamics around drug tourism can be and have been. And then if we look at, you know, in 2018, I think it came out that two MAPS Canada therapists had been involved in a case of abuse with a MAPS Canada study participant. And these were people who were on the record. Like, I have video up on YouTube of them making, sketchy comments about knowing back in the 80s, knowing tons of therapists who were running around sleeping with their clients, talking about how phenethylamines are a particularly sort of dangerous or seductive class of compounds as far as the likelihood that therapists will want to sexually engage with their patients. And this was a husband and wife couple named Richard Jensen and Donna Dreyer. The amount of shit that's been swept under the rug around some of this stuff. Like, when you actually look through some of the circles of who's been engaged in abuse and who they know and who they're connected to and who they've been sort of protected by, like, when I look at the field, it seems to me that there's a pretty clear body of evidence about, like, authoritarian tendencies within psychedelic therapy, and this notion that, like, I'm the therapist, I'm going to fix you, I'm going to break you down and build you up. And if you have a problem with that, like, it's your own resistance, it's your own issues, like I am in charge here. Like, yeah. To me, that's majorly concerning.
Yeah. I mean, this, when you're talking about this, it just reminds me of, sounds a lot like, I did an interview, it was last year, I guess, or over a year ago, with Matthew Remsky, who is one of the co-hosts of Conspirituality Now, the Conspirituality podcast. And I mean, he himself has been involved in yoga for a long time. He himself was in a few cults, I think one or two cults within the yoga community, if you want to call it that. And yeah, the way you're saying about the therapy, the therapist situation, and people that are in extremely vulnerable positions, when you take like ayahuasca or mushrooms or LSD, like, you're not in a place where you can make, you know, you're very suggestible. You're in a very, very vulnerable place. And if you have this dynamic with somebody who's taking advantage of that, I mean, yeah. I mean, we see, again, that's something that Remsky talks about within yoga, the kind of gurus, the authoritarian tendencies within that, those circles. And yeah, I've heard a lot of this stuff with psychedelia as well, like psychedelic tourism. And yeah, I don't know. I guess this is a tangent in a way, and it's not sort of connected a little bit, but it's not really, because when I was thinking about doing this interview with you, I had two things, which is what we've already kind of talked about a bit with legalization versus decriminalization, the corporatization of psychedelics, medicalization of psychedelic use. But also, I mean, just again, listening to your more recent stuff on Plus Three, and just some of our recent articles published on Symposia. I mean, you highlighted, I think it was you or someone else had written an article about how like the intersections of conspiracy theory and kind of far right politics, like QAnon stuff, like pandemic, like I think it was highlighted, like the QAnon shaman Jake Angeli, who was the topless dude with tattoos and the Viking horns that went into the Capitol, the Senate. He has his own history of that, as well as Mickey Willis, who is the director of the Plandemic mock, whatever you want to fucking call it, faux documentary, whatever that, I don't want to call it documentary, but whatever you want to call it.
Propaganda film.
Propaganda film, yeah, disinformation. But he also had produced a documentary previous to that, interviewing like Dennis McKenna and like some prominent psychedelic individuals, people in the psychedelic field, like
Neurons to Nirvana, I think was a film that he was on as a producer. And I mean, that was aired at like every conference and, you know, at festivals and stuff after it came out as like that, this sort of like, you know, big flashing beacon for how, I guess the psychedelic science community's coming of age, if you will, right? Like the Renaissance is here, and look, it's in high gloss and high production. And yeah.
And it's just, I mean, this harkens back to Brian Pace and his article, Lucy in the Sky with Nazis.
Nazis. Yep.
Yeah. I was like, it's not diamonds, it's Nazis. But just the like,
I feel like that's a common refrain these days. It's not diamonds, it's Nazis.
Oh my God. I guess that there's that strain of it too, where there is this, again, speaking to the naivety that I had going into psychedelics, personally, my whole understanding of it. I guess what I've realized is, like, you mentioned MK Ultra earlier. There's a couple things going on at once with psychedelics. You've got this sort of, you have the CIA and you have these other like nefarious organizations that were using psychedelics, not for all the things that we're interested in doing with them. They were literally wanted to like control people and figure out ways to break them, like through interrogation, these types of things. Right. And then you also have just the fact that, like, I don't know, just that there's the far right that's a part of this as well, and this sort of conspiracy theory side of it too. And it's just, it's not one thing. And so it seems like it's gotta be, like, that's again like why I really like Symposia, because it is, you're unabashedly critical of
thanks
these things. Yeah, I don't know, I just have to like talk about that, because like, who the fuck else is going to talk about the fact that Jordan Peterson, who is a right-wing figure,
mm-hmm.
is somebody who, as I've listened to, spoke very, very eloquently about psychedelic experiences, even if he hasn't had any himself.
Sure.
We've got the Mickey Willis dude peddling disinformation, misinformation on COVID. I mean, all of these figures that have been in the psychedelic world that have just like moved in this like QAnon plandemic direction, and it's so like weird. Like, I don't know what it is about the psychedelic community that allows for these spaces to like, allows for these types of people to kind of participate in psychedelic research or exploration, and then also have these really fucked up politics, you know?
Well, there's a few things that come to mind. I mean, and thinking about like characters who've like sort of popularized psychedelics, thinking about Joe Rogan, I know Pace caught quite a bit of flack for the way that he described Rogan in Lucy. And yet when you look at it, you know, and we've continued to sort of talk about that and talk about the fact that, you know, it seems hard to find a far right character that Rogan hasn't liked, particularly when he's had them on.
Uh-huh.
And somebody commented on the video we just put up about the Castalia Foundation, which is like this Timothy Leary revived, or it's a revived sort of organization that was started by Tim Leary, but it's like Tim Leary plus QAnon. And just like when you look at the things that this new founded organization is promoting, it's all very bizarre. But somebody commented and said, well, hey, you know, Rogan gives everybody equal opportunity. And I pointed out that, like, look, if you're going to say it's equal opportunity to have like a moderate progressive like Bernie alongside the founder of the neo-fascist Proud Boys, who Rogan refers to as like mostly a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's
like,
just,
I'm sorry, Gavin McGinnis, like you're platforming McGinnis and saying that he's mostly a good guy. Like, no, just no.
Yeah. Yeah.
But sorry. Your point about like shitty politics, like one of the things that it's taken me like a while to articulate and to actually get into a coherent, digestible form, but I think political tensions are at the heart of psychedelic experiences. Like if you consider sort of boundary dissolution, if you look through, let's say at this point, 70 years of trip reports, you can find common themes, right? You can find themes about nature connectedness, sort of unitive experiences, the notion that you're fine just the way you are, self-acceptance, right? And if you take these themes and you come back to the world that you live in, if you have a trip that says, you know, all there is love, like you are love, the universe is love. And then you come back into an environment where there's hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in ad spends saying that you're unlovable unless you buy the right products. Like, how could that be anything but a political tension? Or sure. If we look at something like ecological integrity, you know, and this is where I think some of the QAnon stuff can, and far right ideology comes in, where like, if you look at something that demonstrates nature connectedness and you feel like, you know, in touch with your land base, that can promote a deep ecological perspective, whatever other sort of greeny perspective, or I think it can feed notions of eco-fascism. I mean, if we look at the El Paso, Texas Walmart shooter mm-hmm. saying, hey, look, there's not enough resources on this planet, so we have to kill all the brown people. I mean, the notion that that's not coming from some sort of like ecologically informed place. I mean, the politics are fucked, don't get me wrong, but to look at what's undergirding that sort of thought. And I think this comes back to some of our early discussion about, you know, having experiences that we plugged in whatever ways, but then having conversations with other people where whatever they brought to the table or their own experiences didn't result in those types of insight. And so it's sort of like, if psychedelics present suggestible states, if psychedelics present a certain degree of mirroring and sort of require whatever sort of content you've got already ricocheting around your cranium, mm-hmm. then I think that it's likely that will shape things. And when you see members of the, you know, far right, whether we're talking about members of the base who were arrested in Virginia a couple years back, or maybe it was just a year ago, right? It's like they had weapons violations. One of them, I think, had illegally crossed the border from Canada after spreading all sorts of like neo-fascist propaganda, and they were producing, I think, extracting DMT, right? Mm-hmm. Or you look at Adam Woffen members talking about how mushrooms are like Ubermensch, or Russell Hossfeld was just trolling, I think it was the Daily Stormer, looking at some of the messaging boards, and you find all sorts of like really abhorrent comments about using psychedelics for advancing notions of white supremacism, or for, you know, like, oh, you know, imagine that you gave this to such and such a person and they had to deal with the realities of like, you know, white supremacy, or the fact that, you know, this is the master race. And so you see that psychedelic exceptionalism exists sort of across the spectrum, the notion that using psychedelics to propagate a certain mindset is not just the idea of certain researchers who are looking to promote nature connectedness and anti-authoritarianism. But as you pointed out, right, you've got it with Jake Angeli at the Capitol running around, you know, covered in appropriated Norse iconography, and looking at some of the conspirituality that he was peddling. I mean, there are also, I think, interesting questions about the way that fascism as a ideology or as a sort of political mode requires that fact-free sort of existence, right? That requires an alternative reality in which to make myth and make meaning and then prop up notions of like authoritarians in power because of some mythologized past or because of some notion of addressing wrongs and making them right. Like having that sort of QAnon, what to call it, like a cauldron just kind of bubbling, yeah. You know. Like,
yeah, yeah. It's a soup. QAnon, yeah. The soup. Yeah. The soup of a lot of, yeah. No, I just want to address something, because that thing about fascism is that it is there's metaphysical elements to it. There's like a deep, like, you know, spiritual quality to it, or like there's occultic qualities to it, and I think psychedelia fits into that side of it, so I can see the connection there. I can see that. Yeah
And when you talk about, you know, people like to talk about psychedelics as like ego deflating or whatever. But like, you know, if you look around psychedelic spaces, there's a whole lot of narcissism and, and the inflationary period, especially for like people who are new to psychedelics, like it's a real thing. And seeing some of these like grandiose ideologies, I mean, looking at some of, you know, Mickey Willis's work and the way that when he got pushback and then he was making public statements about how he was willing to die for his ideas or his beliefs, you know. And then of course he shows up at the Capitol as well. You know, I find it concerning that when this is the context, or when Rebecca Mercer is donating $1 million to MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, in order to fund MDMA for PTSD research, right? Particularly in troops. Like, I think she specified that her donation was just for that purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, these things within psychedelia aren't acknowledged as political, right? The notion that, like, sort of dominant culture just is what it is. It exists. Like, that's just the normative state. Yet calling attention to that, like we try to do at symposia or trying to cast a critical lens about like, hey, if MDMA is being made from petrochemicals, but you're claiming that somehow this is going to like resolve questions of ecological integrity or indigenous folks, like when you look at where this stuff is coming from and you look at the effects on indigenous land base and you look at like what's gone on with Chevron in the Amazon, or, you know, other oil companies in the Amazon, like the fact that there are people within psychedelia espousing that, like, oh, these corporations are actually saying that they're going to set aside whatever percentage and give back to indigenous populations. It's like, you can't destroy indigenous communities and say that if you give back 5% of your profits, you're meaningfully helping. But that abounds. And if you question that, then you're being political. Or if you question, like, should MAPS be working with cops and soldiers? That's too political. But the notion of treating cops and soldiers somehow isn't.
Right. Yeah. It's so weird how they try to force it as if it is an apolitical thing. And it absolutely isn't. Of course not. Of course not. What the fuck are they talking about? I don't know. It's just so like silly to me. Like, of course it's political. Of course it's political. I don't know. And even just the context of how psychedelics became culturally relevant in the US or in the Western world in the past, 50, 60, 70 years, or however long it's been since like the 50s. That was a political thing. I mean, I don't know. Like, it happened during this countercultural movement, revolutionary period, or whatever you want to call it, during the 60s. I mean, of course it's political. I just don't. I don't know. And I just wanted go on. Sorry.
Just a super quick point on that. Like, there's this thing. So there's two things that I think happen within the research community. There's what I call the ghost of Leary fallacy, where people are like, oh, you know, Leary made problems and then psychedelics were criminalized and that's what happened. Mm. But if you actually look at it, like, there was already clampdowns on LSD research that were coming as a result of congressional inquiries into other like issues with medicine and the like. I mean, Leary was pushing at that point for like credentialed, you know, some sort of certifying body and this, that, and the other. But the other thing is, there's this mythologized notion of like almost the sanctity of the lab. Like, if psychedelics hadn't escaped from the lab, then we could have produced all of this wonderful research and that would have benefited society in all of these ways. And yet it misses completely the fact that, like, as you point out, like, when psychedelics spilled into the underground and into the counterculture, like, those were experiences that informed the anti-war movement, that informed certain aspects of the ecological movements, that, you know, played certain roles as far as civil rights struggles, you know, in different arenas. And when you look at to contend that somehow the social impact would have been greater if they'd stayed in the lab rather than escaping, like, to me, it just totally skips any sort of real world engagement with like the historical realities.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No, you didn't. You're good. I'm supposed to be interviewing you at this point. No, I mean, this is a good discussion more than anything, but I just wanted to throw this in there because it was just, I don't know if it even fits, but I just wanted to share this experience I had. Like, this was probably like 3 or so years ago. There was a solar eclipse that where I live in Southern Idaho, that was like the solar eclipse was like right there. So like where I was at, it was like 90 something percent eclipse.
Yep.
Right. So I was like, this is a good day to take LSD. Fuck it. So I took some LSD. I didn't time it correctly, unfortunately. So the eclipse happened before it really took effect. But anyways, what happened is I was just at home like all day with my cat, just kind of tripping, listening to music. Just, you know, I had a really beautiful introspective experience, you know. But at that moment, and I just want to talk about like what's kicking around in your head, like the set and setting, like what is going on, what it's working with. This is when I kind of realized that it is a tool that is working with ideas that you already have, which is why you, David, could be like, I am already becoming radicalized and politicized in a very particular way. And of course, I'm going to acknowledge all of these things and they're going to be highlighted during the psychedelic experience. But other people who don't have those ideas kicking in their head just don't have that thought ever occur to them.
Sure.
So I had just done, I think I was just starting to do interviews regularly for the podcast. I interviewed a professor named David Scribina, who I think is a professor of philosophy, and he does like philosophy of technology. And he had actually published a book of his correspondence with Ted Kaczynski, who was a Unabomber, right? So I've been fascinated by the Unabomber, like without endorsing even all of his ideas or his, obviously what he did as far as being an actual homegrown terrorist, domestic terrorist. But one thing I remembered and I had learned before doing that interview with David Scribina was there was a documentary that came out about Kaczynski, in which he apparently, I think he was going to Stanford as a student. People need to understand that Ted Kaczynski also had like extremely high IQ. He's a mathematician, just, you know, very, very smart in that regard. And he was involved in the early like experiments that I think the CIA was doing with LSD.
Harvard, I believe.
Oh, Harvard.
And yeah. Okay. He had a professor who like put him through some real serious mental, like psychological abuse, but sorry, please.
Involving LSD. So
yep.
That seems to be the point in his personal trajectory where he became like anti-civilizational, kind of this neo-Luddite kind of perspective where he's like, I'm just going to fucking abandon this whole thing and move out into the woods and have a little cabin. And that's, you know, eventually led to him doing what he did. And anyway, as I'm tripping on LSD, I'm thinking about all this shit. And in that state, I totally could understand Kaczynski's perspective. Like, obviously, I never went down that path, but like,
sure.
My point is like, if you're like a 15-year-old or 21-year-old or whatever, and you're like reading some 4chan shit about, you know, race essentialism and white supremacy and all of this stuff, and then you take a psychedelic experience, it is not a guarantee that the psychedelic you take is going to challenge those ideas. It may just reinforce them.
Totally. And right? If you look at the social context and who you're around, I mean, if you're on, let's say 4chan, 8chan, whatever, right? And instead of having a bunch of people being like, hey man, that's kind of weird or fucked up that you're saying that, right? Instead you get like a bunch of affirmation.
Yeah.
I mean, and especially like in a world full of, you know, increasingly atomized people prior to the pandemic, never mind in the context of pandemic, right? Like at the point where people feel cut off, people feel isolated, people are looking for easy explanations and ways to cast blame. The notion of these sorts of easy answers, or if you look at Q, right, the sort of live action role playing where you can now be the protagonist in your own sort of quest, you know, throw in a little acid. Now, I'm going to go ahead and throw this out here because I'm assuming by the time that this is live, we'll already have it, but have it up. We received a heads up from somebody, and Brian Pace is currently should be working on a short article on it. But the guy who is next to Angeli in the Capitol, like he's got like this huge beard.
Yeah.
And there's one where like Angeli's like holding the flag and the guy's to the side of him. And so that guy was actually out on like, I don't know if it was like $100,000 bail or something crazy for weed, LSD, and maybe some other drug possession and distribution. And if you look, I think he's got a tattoo of Gamma Goblin, which is a sort of prolific underground dark web supplier of LSD, mescaline, psychedelics. He's got a tattoo of the Gamma Goblin logo on him, right? So here's another moment where like, oh, it's like, look, two of perhaps the most notable or like kind of graphic figures in this riot, you know, are both seem to have some sort of psychedelic connection. And in the case of like Kaczynski and looking at, I mean, and this comes back to the MK Ultra shit, as you point out, like looking at the type of the fact that it wasn't just like psychedelics, but psychedelics plus this sort of strain of authoritarian abuse treatment. I mean, we've seen Ewan Cameron up in Canada. There's people in Mexico. There's people throughout the US where you were talking about psychedelics plus torture. And, you know, when you look at what was used, I think it was at Gitmo and other, you know, and US black sites, like the notion of putting people in stress positions, bombarding them with loud music, flashing lights, like these were things that were done in coordination with psychedelic drug, you know, with dosing people. And in some cases, you know, the CIA internally, they were also just sort of all dosing each other. I mean, it was a pretty looking at what was going on in the agency around the time of MK Ultra. Yeah. And in the case of Kaczynski, I mean, so I'll point out, I think it was the Chicago Times. I think it was when Apple X or the iPhone X came out, they ran an article that was something like Ted was right. Which was wild to see from a mainstream paper. And I think leaving aside the actions he took and the questions around that, like the reality is we do have these huge looming questions about industrial civilization that I can tell you from my own experience are uncomfortable to grapple with on psychedelics. But beyond that, like they make people uncomfortable to even raise in public. And one of the things that's come up for me in the context of trying to talk about psychedelics for ways of reimagining the world we live in is to try to look at some of the really complex interconnections and the costs associated with it. Like one of the questions that came to me in the wake of a psychedelic experience and then talking with a friend trying to unpack some of the benefits of industrial civilization was, if we come to the conclusion that modern medicine is maybe one of the best, if not the highest sort of value that industrial civilization could offer, like what's the body count of a hospital? Like if we actually think about like the hospital that was near me where I was living at the time, it was running off of a coal-fired power plant. So it's like all of the coal that they were bringing to North Carolina from West Virginia, right? You had the mountaintop removal. You had the toxification of the water supplies around that. You had the pollution to people, never mind like people who were watching their land base just get decimated. You had all the deaths of the animals. You then have the transportation from West Virginia to North Carolina. So then you're burning the coal, right? But then your hospital itself, you've got all of the concrete and the carbon that goes into that. You've got all of the computer processors and all of the rare earth mining and refining for that, plus your MRI, fMRI, CAT scan, right? That's all being mined and refined in China by people who are never going to get the benefits of that particular hospital, but bear all the ecological and labor exploitation costs, you know, and then there I am, right, on Obamacare, able to access like a small portion of what that hospital has to offer if I get sick and potentially still looking at huge medical debts. And then, of course, you have things like liquid oxygen, all of the plastics, all of the metals, you know, all of the logistics and transportation networks. And it's like, to me, at the end of the day, it seems pretty simple to say, okay, this isn't necessarily about saving lives full stop. This is about saving certain lives in certain places who can afford in the US access to that care. So is this really, like, if this is the greatest good, sort of, who is this the greatest good for? And can we actually, like, is this justifiable? Mm-hmm. And I know that makes people really uncomfortable because you start, you know, you can do it for everything, right? You can do it for what's the cost of a server farm? Like, it's great. Like, I'm thrilled to be able to chat with you. Like, I'm thrilled to be able to, like, have conversations with people all around the world and, sure, and like, engage in these exchanges of ideas. But if we think about the suffering that that's predicated on, like, I would rather live in a world where, like, that level of communication wasn't possible because there wasn't all of the sort of horrific byproducts or atrocities at the core of it. But again, like that level of there's a lot of discomfort, you know, like would people even be willing to give up like HVAC, you know, AC, heat, sort of like where, right, where do the lines get drawn and who gets to make those decisions?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't
particularly
know,
in a world with billionaires.
Sorry. Sure. For sure. Yeah. I mean, well, and I think there's this other part to it where like one of the, you mentioned the Mercer's funding or providing some financial support for MAPS, which of course is at the forefront of psychedelic research and getting it legalized, at least in the United States. And it seems like, I think in the United Kingdom too, as well, I think they have their, could be wrong, but.
Yeah, MAPS is looking to get into Europe. I'm not sure where they stand. Compass, the psilocybin folks are, they're headquartered in London and are, as I understand, they're the people behind some imperial studies and looking to get into some other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So with specifically with like MAPS, I feel like them pushing for the legalization of MDMA is centered around therapy for people that have PTSD. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned with the Mercer specifically, they're like, we want to provide therapy, adequate therapy, which MDMA is amazing for, like, that's true. In conjunction with, you know, having a therapist and a person present and all that. But this is specifically for the troops, for veterans, for people in the military who have left the military, who obviously like serving in the military, even just going through boot camp and all of the things you have to do to become a trained soldier, that itself, in my opinion, is a traumatizing experience. I know people who have served in the military, never fought, never engaged in combat. They came out of that fucked up. Like they have serious PTSD just because of the nature of the military and how it's structured. Now, what I see is like, what should happen is you take have a psychedelic experience and you realize like, oh, we shouldn't have the military. Like we should live in a world where this isn't like, what the fuck is this? Instead, it's like, let's just treat soldiers so they can continue to operate at the highest level possible. And if that means implementing LSD or MDMA into the equation, then we're for it. So again, just like you know, they don't really want to have this deeper political analysis and analyzing like the systemic issues that are producing mental health issues in the first place. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. And I just want to say, sorry, one thing, please. And this last thing is like, there was such a potent example of this in, again, the most recent +3 podcast that you were, I don't know if you were saying it or who you were with on that, talking about these, again, these people promoting psychedelic therapy and stuff and helping with mental health issues during the pandemic and driving past people who are houseless. I mean, like,
oh, that was Brian Pace. Yeah.
That was Brian Pace. Okay. It's like, so you see this,
or Brian Norman, but yeah, Brian Norman,
yeah. Like this huge, like, looming, not looming, it's a present crisis and it's only getting worse where people are being evicted. There is mental health issues involved in that. Going to them and saying, if you just take this compound, we'll be able to address your mental health issues. I'm like, motherfucker, I don't have a house. What are you talking about?
Yep.
You trip on the street? What are you fucking saying? That doesn't make any sense. It's so pathetic and absurd. And that's what they're selling to us, it seems like. Yeah, I get the mental health issues and how this is a part of that, and anything that we can do to help people get through that, any tools at our disposal, if MDMA or whatever it is used in the proper context, great. But let's not get away from the fundamental material conditions that are producing these crises to begin with. It's like slapping people over the fucking head. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, no, that's, and there's so much there. Like, so things that come to mind just immediately in response to that are, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, Hawaii. I think the governor of Hawaii was looking to, was looking to have homelessness designated as a health issue. Because it would allow them to free up certain funds that had been earmarked for health spending, but that weren't getting spent. And they were like, look, if we can designate homelessness as a health issue, we can actually prescribe housing and we can use this funding to subsidize housing for homeless folks, recognizing that, like, when you get people into housing, looking at it in that sort of pure, horrible economic sense, like the costs associated with, you know, not having a permanent residence, you have all sorts, the same way looking, look, excuse me, looking at preventative treatment versus like ER, right? Like the notion of when you have somebody who's got like a stable residence who can then get the services they need, like if they need mental health care, like you now have an address at which like services can be rendered. You have like all of these things that follow from having a stable place to live. And like, sure, you could talk about psychedelic treatments down the line, but when you're dealing with those material realities, there are fundamental things that I think quite clearly should precede psychedelic for mental health care. And on top of that, you know, and that also leaves aside the question of like what the degree to which houselessness like creates worse effects, right, from some of these issues, especially when we're talking about things like exposure, especially when we're talking about in the context of pandemic. I mean, there's like such a likely cascade of effects on the back of that, that, you know, starting with securing like food, clothes, shelter seems like a pretty logical place to me. But with you talking about the, say, MDMA for PTSD in troops or what have you, like, and you brought up the point about basic training. Like, I have a friend who is doing psychedelic therapy, who is a therapist, who is doing, I think they were approved for ketamine and cannabis therapy. Mm-hmm. And they were working with populations of folks who had been enlisted. And some of those people, when they described their experiences going through basic, when they described the cultures of alcoholism and the sort of substance abuse that they were subjected to, the type of hazing, the type of trauma, you know, never mind like the early childhood trauma that a number of them seem to have experienced. Like there are so many underlying issues there that like, when they were treating them, they were unpacking. And again, in some cases, you're talking about people who haven't served, people who, when you look at the suicidality among American service members, you see that the majority of people who are killing themselves are folks who have not seen actual combat, which raises, again, huge questions about what the fuck is going on in basic that's like contributing to this. Mm-hmm. And then you think about, okay, so you have a military spend, right? Each enlisted person comes with a price tag for the, you know, the military. So if you're able to spend a significantly smaller amount of money on MDMA therapy in order to keep people combat ready, or at least not killing themselves, you know, there seems to be a purely economic incentive to that. And then looking at the way that some of this stuff gets broken down, I mean, I think it leads to people misemphasizing things. So there was a quote that Rick Doblin, the head of MAPS, gave in 2006, where he said, "I started thinking about how traumatic it would be for a police officer to see the murdered body of a pregnant woman. I experienced some compassion for the police." And then as a result of that, MAPS and this other organization developed a memorandum of understanding for a potential study of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD in Canadian RCMP officers. And when I read that quote, I was just struck by the fact that like, so you heard about a murdered pregnant woman and immediately you thought about how traumatic it would be for the cop finding her body. Like what about her family? What about like, that's just such a weird, like, it strikes me as such a misplaced, engagement. Yeah. And it seems, you know, I, this is purely speculative, but like, this has that sort of support the troops logic, right? That if you can support, you know, back the blue, support the troops, like there's that propaganda inherent to that, which I would agree with you. I think that's inherently resistant to the notion of engaging in systemic critique, because at the point where you're asking, well, why do we have police, or why do we have soldiers, or why are we engaged in endless foreign wars? You're already so far off script as far as, you know, what we're expected to engage in as far as societal norms that can't really have that.
Right. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. This is probably my final thing. I mean, I'm curious what's coming up now with Symposia, with you specifically, and also just this website, these group of people that you're associated with, that you're working with. I mean, maybe this is two things. First is like what direction this organization you're a part of is going in, what you're going in, like what you're working on, but also like what are you doing to... Like what's coming next? I know we kind of went into a little bit of a dystopian direction.
Sure.
But like, what are your fears, I guess, or what kind of keeps you up at night regarding like psychedelic corporatization, medicalization, etc.? Like, where do you, and how do you think Symposia is going to be able to counter that or work with that?
Sure. So I think coming next from Symposia, we have a few different projects in the pipeline of sort of differing scale. We have, I think in the near term, there's going to be a little bit more on what we might broadly call psychedelic authoritarianism, ranging from like stuff that we saw at the Capitol. And like I said, the rundown of, say, some of these other psychedelic QAnon figures, which of course, when we publish that, we always get pushback of you guys are giving psychedelics a bad name or people are going to think badly. But it's like, hey, if we can't acknowledge this is happening, we're not going to be able to address it. And if we don't address it, then, hey, we've got a bunch of Nazis in the space.
You're just a buzzkill. That's all you're doing. You're just a buzzkill. Yeah. Jesus. All right.
So we've got some stuff coming out about, it's probably not fair to call him a therapist. We've got stuff coming out about like practitioners who are on the record admitting to abuse. In one case, we've got this guy who's talking about everything from like vomiting on people to, I think he says he's never been sexual with a client, but he's just touched their genitals when they've needed that. And we've got a 2-hour video of him, like it's just clip after clip of truly atrocious shit that like he was happy to put on the record. So we'll be doing a breakdown of some of that at some point. Okay. We have a couple larger. Oops,
I just said okay.
What was that?
Okay. Yeah. That's all. Okay.
We've got some larger projects that I can't really talk about yet. If they hit, I think that. So as somebody who was sort of anti-institutional within psychedelia for a long time, because I think institutions have a habit of sort of ossifying and getting stagnant and like existing to perpetuate themselves rather than push ideas. I think we've got a few things that like for Symposia would really be kind of groundbreaking, reporting and investigative stuff. Hopefully within the next month or so, we should have like approval on that project and be rolling forward. With some of that stuff, it's just hard because, you know, making sure that like your sources are safe, making sure that you've got like legal coverage if you're going to be wading into something where there's allegations and assertions being made. Right. Yeah, it's been a new experience for us, and I'm really hopeful that things will go well with that. Personally, I've had a writing project that I've been trying to get out for months, just trying to deal with like a conceptual breakdown of what's going on in psychedelia, sort of just like rough sketches of psychedelics and capitalism, psychedelics and surveillance capitalism, practitioner abuse, questions about like industrial civilization, just sort of like one of the things that I find is a lot of institutions and organizations in the space don't seem to engage in much like conceptual or theoretical work around what the terrain looks like and why it looks that way. And like trying to put what I would call like explanatory models out there, right? Things that have some sort of predictive power to say, these are the systems we exist within. These are the way they function. So we should expect some of this and we should be cautious of these outcomes. So it's probably going to be a 6 or 7 part series. I've got a bunch of rough text for it, but need to clean it up. So that's been my big project, but I haven't been able to actually like put in the time. And as far as like just broader concerns, it's really the psychedelics and surveillance capitalism. The practitioner abuse is concerning as well. But I think as we're seeing such a rapid scaling in what they're calling like a sector that's worth potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, never mind the fact that none of the companies involved in it have turned any sort of profit, right? So this is all just like speculation. I think we're going to see huge pressures to ramp things up and to do so in rather shady manners that both involve like not particularly well-trained or qualified practitioners, plus a whole bunch of attempts to outsource things to artificial intelligence and like machine learning. And I think that there's a lot of potential for harm and for exploitation, plus surveillance.
Yeah, that's my feeling too. unfortunately.
Bright times ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I just appreciate the honesty and the clear analysis. And,
thanks.
You know, I don't care about having a, you know, a peachy outlook about things if it's just not accurate. Like, who gives a
right.
shit about that, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, and I think people like myself and in my own way and what you all do at Symposia is I don't know, we're the people at the party that talks about like fucking abrupt climate change, you know, like right. you know what I mean, like what, like what do you do? Oh, I talk about these things. Oh, let's get into that. And I'm like, all right, you sure? I mean, we're like eating pancakes and drinking right. whatever. I'm like, it's just like that's what it feels like anyway. But I don't know, these are the kind of conversations I would rather have. I would rather approach it in this way than not. For sure.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. And, you know, I've really loved the episodes of yours that I've gotten to listen to. I mean, the fact that you had like Sylvia Federici and just like, yeah, it's been really, it's awesome to see. And I hadn't realized early on that like you had the psychedelic connection until I heard the episode with Pace. Yeah. And then you were sort of hearkening back to some of that. So it's great to make those connections within whatever the broader left, post-left world.
Yeah, whatever we are, whatever I am. And I just want to say, just as an important note, like we're doing, like me talking about psychedelics and bringing you on and having this perspective now is because I deeply fucking respect psychedelics and what they've done for me and what they've done for people I care about.
Totally.
And I don't want this dystopian world you kind of addressed there. I mean, I don't want that. So
totally.
This is because we love psychedelics. And if people that are like, you know, proponents of psychedelic use can't see that, that's really on them. Like they're not, they don't get, they think that we're trying to, or you and Symposia are trying to like stop something that's, you know, like legalization or whatever, all these processes from happening. It's like, no, we just don't want it to turn into this fucking hellscape situation. Well,
I know, I appreciate your saying that because it really does come from a, like the notion that this would be uncontested terrain for the tech bros to just run rampant over, or that like, you know, that this is coming because like, I don't know, we're somehow like antagonistic towards psychedelics. No, it's precisely what you say. It's like these have offered some of the most meaningful, profound, both ontologically like shattering and also like therapeutically beneficial experiences of my life. The notion that these would be in the control of people like the Mercers or Peter Thiel or whomever, like, it just seems so fundamentally at odds with my own experiences of them. And to be willing to call that shit out, right? To be willing to say, like, this is the world we would like to see. And, you know, we're trying to take whatever steps to get there.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much for everything you've shared today with me. I really am glad we've connected. Final thing is, of
likewise.
Course, yeah, like people can check out Symposia at symposia.com and also support Symposia on Patreon, which is, I think, patreon.com/symposia. Is that right?
That's where we're at.
Where would people be able to, I mean, obviously I will be linking to your articles on Symposia, but where else can people find your work specifically?
People can find me, I guess at this moment I'm sort of most active on social media on Twitter. It's D_NICKLES. So D_Nichols. Aside from that, I mean, the Symposia account is also up on Twitter, just at Symposia. We've got like a tip line up on the website. Pretty much those are probably the best spaces. We're really trying to get into like broader sort of leftist, engagement and try to pivot away from the echo chamber of psychedelia and make connections within. I mean, because we know, like, right, there's a whole bunch of people who use psychedelics and are interested in psychedelics, but aren't involved in the more, quote, mainstream psychedelic community. And we're really trying to break out of that echo chamber.
Right. Yeah, I think it's great to see the crossover there and see like just the articles and stuff that Symposia shares is like not about psychedelics, but it's obviously relevant to what the goals of Symposia are. And I would just say also the podcast Plus Three, very good. People can subscribe to that as well. So I'll be putting all the resources in the description, of course. And
cool. Thanks.
Yeah, it's so good to meet. Thank you so much for coming on.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. Great to connect.